Now, there are times when reading the Bible feels very remote and distant. The culture feels really alien, the characters quite unfamiliar. And then there are times when you suddenly realize that people are people are people, and human nature hasn't changed very much. When you realize that the questions and concerns that come up in every generation. Questions of identity. Who am I? And who are my people? Questions of belonging. Where is my place in the world? Where is home? Questions of how we live and how we look after people. Whose responsibility is it? And concerns about our legacy, safeguarding our future, the future of our offspring. Now, these are the questions which I see as I look around, as I listen to people, as I read newspapers and books. Sometimes these questions are asked really quite directly, and sometimes they're the questions which kind of sit underneath issues which are raised. But they are there, and they are important. So this week, my Facebook feed turned orange as my mum posted pictures of a day which was really significant for her. Last week, she had the swearing-in ceremony as she became a Dutch citizen. Some of you will know that I was born in Holland and lived there on and off growing up. And for the last 20 years, my parents have lived there. And it's a country and a culture which they have for a long time celebrated and embraced, and now which she's made the formal step of becoming part of in a whole new way. So there was orange flags, there was an orange feather boa, there was orange drink. If you don't know, the national colour of Holland is orange. Here is my place in the world, she said. Here is home. Naga Munchetti became a news story this week rather than just being a news reader, having been reprimanded for comments made about a tweet by Donald Trump. He tweeted that four female politicians of colour should go back home where they came from. And in a short discussion with her colleague, Naga commented that in her experience as a woman of colour, being told to go home was always embedded in racism. Her comments broke the rules, apparently. But what about his? Go back where you came from. You don't belong here. This is not your home. And when we turn to the book of Ruth in the Bible, this small book with just four chapters in it, we see a story which touches on these deep questions. We have the story of Ruth, the Moabitess, the outsider who comes in, who joins the people of God, but for whom there are obstacles as well as invitations as she finds her place in the world and in God's family. And the end of the story is truly remarkable, because not only does her place appear to be completely embedded within God's family, she also finds herself as part of the lineage which then goes down to David, Israel's greatest king, and which we also then find goes on to Jesus. So in a culture where the purity of the family line seemed to be important, what does it say about God that Ruth the Moabitess finds herself in the genealogy of his son? Let's look again at the story. And for those of you who have not been here for the last few sermons of Ruth, here is my previously in the book of Ruth. So we've started with an Israelite family. We had Elimelech, Naomi, Kilion, and Mahlon, who lived in Bethlehem. But a famine drives them from their land and they move to Moab, where their two sons get married to Orpah and Ruth. Then tragically, the father and the sons die. And so, with no husband or sons to look after them, and remembering the extreme patriarchal society that existed at the time, Naomi decides the best course of action is to head back to her homeland. She persuades her daughter-in-law, Orpah, to return to her own family for a better chance of a new life. But Ruth will not be swayed. She clings to Naomi and makes an astounding statement. She says, "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." It's an incredible pledge made out of love and faithfulness to her mother-in-law. And I think this is the moment where she truly became one of the people of God. We've seen what happens this morning in the ceremony of baptism and the profound words and promises which are made. And to me, Ruth's promise, her pledge, feels very much along these lines. But life in Bethlehem is not easy for two widows. And Ruth has to go gleaning in the field to get food for them. That's picking up the leftover grain after the farmers have been through the harvest. And as she's doing this, Boaz, the owner of the field, she catches his eye. And he notices her and inquires after this woman. And it seems she's developed a reputation already for her faithfulness. And so Boaz treats her abundantly kindly. And when Ruth goes back to Naomi and reports his kindness, Naomi's clever mind immediately gets to work concocting a plan because Boaz is actually a distant relative and there are laws which come into play, laws which are designed to look after widows. Last week, Bridget spoke to us about the law of levirate marriage. And so far, these laws appear not to have been enacted upon. Can you see that theme coming out of care, that question of whose responsibility is it? So Ruth listens to her mother-in-law and follows her plan up to a point, and in doing so gets Boaz to agree to act as her guardian redeemer and marry her. But there is a potential snag. Boaz identifies a closer relative who by rights should act in this role, and he needs to be approached first. And that is the point at which we come to today's reading, where we enter our story. So we find ourselves now in this episode where initially kind of Naomi and Ruth step out of center stage for a moment, and Boaz becomes the key negotiator. So he seeks out this relative who, and this law refers to, who should be acting as this guardian redeemer and taking care of the widows. And the translation that we've just read is rather friendly about him. It calls him friend. Oh, yes, hello, friend. Actually, the more accurate translation of that is that Boaz calls the man something like Mr. So-and-so or like Joe Schmo. He's not actually given a proper name, which is interesting because presumably Boaz did know this person, so he knew his name. So why didn't he use it? I think that the author didn't think much of this guy, and I think he might have been breaking the BBC regulations on remaining neutral as well, Mr. Joe Schmo. Bridget raised the question last week about why hadn't he stepped in to act in this position to be guardian redeemer if that is what the law had required. But to be fair to him, in this instance, when Boaz meets him and holds out this responsibility before him, the guy initially says, Okay, then yes, I'll buy the fields and everything. And then Boaz throws in a carefully timed comment about the foreign wife, Ruth the Moabitess, which comes as part of the package. At which point the man drastically changes his tune and says, no, I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. The prospect suddenly becomes too risky. His family, his name, his bloodline, his property might be at risk. He can't get tangled up with a foreigner. Again, perhaps a motivation and attitude which I think we might recognise at work at times in the world today. So he says to Boaz, you go ahead, you do it. He passes on this opportunity and his slipper and the responsibility to Boaz. So now Boaz is in the position where he can do for Ruth what he has promised her on the threshing floor. And this is where Ruth now officially seems to take her place within the community of God. We see the story start building to its climax as Boaz declares, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, of Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, Mahlon's wife, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that the name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today, you are witnesses. Can you see how those big questions and concerns are brought to the fore here? Questions of place, questions of belonging, questions of legacy. The story started with an Israelite family, and now we come back to that same Israelite family, but now it's a family reconstituted. The laws of the land are acting as they should now to protect and provide for the widows and to enable the family line to continue. One more thing has to happen to fully realize this. And here we are told that God acts. When Ruth and Boaz come to make love, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son, the line continuing. And this child is then placed into the arms of Naomi, and what joy she must have felt. Finally, through the actions of this law of Levirate marriage by Boaz and by the faithfulness of Ruth, the family line can continue. And Ruth is held up as this shining example to Naomi. As Naomi is told, remembering this is a very patriarchal society, your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than seven sons has given birth to the son who will renew Naomi's life and sustain her in old age. Bridget and I like that bit. Shall I say it again? Ruth, who loves you and is better to you than seven sons. But there's one more twist in the story. Because interestingly, given all the talk that's already gone on about maintaining the family line and the name, there is also a law and a custom which is changed. Because when you look at the genealogy at the end, the kind of the list of the names of who's father and everything like that, by rights, it should be Naomi and Elimelech who make it into the official list because they've had a child on behalf, Ruth and Boaz have had a child on behalf of Naomi and Elimelech. But if you look down, it's Boaz's name which appears. And also, in Matthew's gospel, much later on, we also have this list, this genealogy of names. And within that list, it says Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, which is referenced. So in a certain extent, the law of the land was used to help these two women in their need. But there's also a sense in which a law and a custom was changed. It was kind of overlooked somehow in order to include Ruth and Boaz in this family line going forward. And so, a foreign woman, Ruth the Moabitess, finds herself in that family line of King David and then of Jesus, God's son. What does it say about God that he includes a foreign woman, Ruth the Moabitess, in the line of his son? Now, for those of you who've been here for the last few weeks, I don't know how you found the story of Ruth as we've engaged with it and delved into it. For some, it was a known story already that you're coming back to. For others, it was completely new, and this is the first time we've explored it. But I think it's a story worth thinking about and pondering with as it touches on those deep questions. In a world when we are still asking the question, what does God have to say about these things, these big questions? What does God say about who I am, about who my people are? What does God say about where my place in the world is and where is home? What does God say about how we look after people and whose responsibility it is? What does God tell us about our legacy and how we are to safeguard the future? And then in the light of these things, in turn, what do we say to our world about these things? And how do we say them? What do we say to our friends and neighbors? What do we say to our employees and our employers? What do we say to our religious leaders and our political leaders? What do we say to them? And what do we do about these things? as we come to making decisions in our own lives. Amen.